At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Hello, word nerds, and welcome to the dictionary. I am always pleased to announce that I have a guest. It's not a common occurrence on this podcast, but every once in a while we've got a guest, and we have a big guest today. It is the one and the only Robert Sapolsky. Robert, what do you like to go by? Robert, Professor Sapolsky, Mr. Bigbeard?
Robert, definitely.
Robert is good. Okay, I can do that. Thank you for coming on to the show. I first learned about you from Alan Alda's podcast, Clear and Vivid. I re-listened to those episodes recently, and one episode in particular was the one that stood out to me, where you were discussing your book Determined, which after the episode I quickly went ahead and ordered, because I find the topic of free will so fascinating. And when somebody says what you have to say so distinctly, I was so curious and fascinated. But we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. Who is Robert? What are the turtles along the way that have gotten Robert to where he is today?
Oh, I don't know. I think the way I think of it most fruitfully is I lucked out in that my parents traumatized me to the exact right extent, so that on one hand, I didn't become like a Long Island ophthalmologist, and on the other, not a terrorist. So it worked out just fine, about halfway in between.
Yeah, that seems like a good level of trauma, the kind that I think we can all deal with. Not too much, not too little. So Long Island, that's where you started the journey?
Well, I actually started in Brooklyn, and I was one of those impossible Brooklynites who insisted that we were not actually on Long Island. If you meet anyone from Brooklyn, they're horrified by the notion that undeniably they actually are in continuous land with Nassau and Suffolk counties, but it's just basically embarrassing.
Yeah. And what was next for your journey? What was the next thing that sort of led you to, you know, I look at my life and I can, if I look at the past, you know, chronologically, I see, oh, that thing sort of led me to this thing, sort of led me to this thing. What was the path that you took from there?
Well, I've sort of spent my career oscillating back and forth between being a laboratory neuroscientist and a primatologist, a field primatologist studying baboons in East Africa. And I was about 12, maybe a little bit younger, when I decided I wanted to go be a primatologist in Africa and started preparing for that. I was about 14 when I decided there was no free will. So kind of just preparing for all these facets for ever since. And then in college, I took an intro neuroscience class, which caused me a great crisis as to whether I was going to be a primatologist or a neuroscientist. And I have lucked out and managed to do some of both.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, how do you figure out how to combine the two of those together?
Well, it's for starters, much of that is in the past now, but
sure.
You sort of balance it. The commonality between my lab work and field work was stress. What does stress do to your health? What does stress do to your brain? And just to like summarize 100 years of findings, it doesn't do good things to your brain. It's got lots to do with memory loss, brain aging, anxiety disorders, depression, loss of empathy, capacity for loss of good judgment. So a focus on that and the field work was focusing on something that like screams out to you the second you study anything with stress, which is some individuals are so much better at dealing with stress than others, some bodies and some psyches. And what I wound up looking at with these baboons, they're out on the savannah in East Africa, big troops, 50-100 animals, like hierarchical competition, aggression, like jostling sharp elbows all over the place. And there's a tremendous difference among baboon individuals as to how well they deal with stress. Your worst rival on the planet shows up and takes a nap 10 yards away. Do you keep doing whatever you're doing? Or do you get into this frenzied, anxious, turmoiled state? That is sort of one way in which you could see the more zen among baboons. And what I did was study the physiology of these guys. I could dart them, anesthetize them, and look at hormone levels, stress hormone levels, see what it was doing to their immune systems, what it had to do with their social rank, their personality. And when you would reach a point of saying, wow, it would be really interesting to know how this is working, like in their hypothalami, then the lab work allows you with like lab rats to be much more invasive and to figure out the nuts and bolts of how the brain responds to stress in not good ways and deals with it. And right around the point where you say, well, that's great, but I wonder if this has anything to do with real like social beings besides lab rats. Whoa, time to go back and look at the primates out in the field. So very nice being able to bounce back and forth between the two.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, you were going out, was it like every summer for 20, 25 years or something?
Yeah. Eventually it wound up being sort of every other summer, but I squeezed out 33 years worth before circumstances ended it. So beyond lucky getting to do that.
Yeah, that is definitely a unique experience among humans. So in regards to stress specifically, how did your field research and your lab research, how did that affect you personally? Did you make changes in your life?
Basically not in the slightest. I've like spent my whole adult life studying about how bad stress is for you and all of that. And it has had zero impact on me. I pay absolutely no attention to any of the things I have found out. Desperately type A, frantic, all of that. So I've benefited absolutely zero from like my life's work.
I mean, just listening to your voice, you know, from Clear and Vivid, I just get to hear the voice on the podcast, and I luckily get to see your face here, but just listening to your voice, you sound very calm and collected. So, I mean, from my perspective, it seems like, you know, you've figured out a way to be very calm and collected and not stressful, but of course, that's only just a little bit of your actual life.
Nah, it's a complete sham. And it just basically, I mean, just as one measure of it, I once tried meditation because everyone was saying how great that is and the science of its benefits is actually quite convincing. And after about 20 minutes, I was ready to have a stroke. It was so antithetical to what my temperament is. So yeah, I can sound calm, but I'm not actually particularly calm, which is why it would be a good thing to go live alone in a tent for months on end, part of each year.
I'm not going to lie. That sounds pretty fun. You know, it's obviously a lot of work and it's a very different situation from our regular human lives in America. But yeah, that sounds like a pretty amazing experience. So your studies have led you throughout these amazing experiences. And at a certain point, well, actually, let's backtrack. You said that at 12 or 14, you decided that there was no free will. How did that come about? How did you make that decision at such a young age?
Oh, I was raised very orthodoxly religious and really believed in it big time and very ritualistic. And I had some sort of very personally focused religious crisis built around, wait a second, God made us, yet we're being judged by God because of these attributes that God caused us to have. And like, this isn't making a whole lot of sense, causing a great deal of distress. And one night I woke up at 2 a.m. and I said, oh, I get it. There's no God. And then about 10 seconds later, and there's no free will. And then 10 more seconds, and the universe is this empty, indifferent vacuum with no meaning. And it's been downhill from there ever since.
Yeah, yeah. Was that sort of the beginning of your scientific life, or had you already been interested in science before that?
Well, I already knew I wanted to be a primatologist, but... And it wasn't until college that sort of realizing neuroscience was an equally interesting way of understanding how we work, how we become who we are. But from the start, it's been from a very mechanistic standpoint. I mean, you study what neurons do, and you study what hormones do, and you study what early experience, and you throw in some genes in there and some culture and ecology, and you put all those pieces together. And not to be too in one's face, we're just biological machines. We're really fancy ones, but we're nothing more than the biology over which we had no control, and its interactions with environment over which we had no control, that caused each of us to arrive where we are.
Yeah, I mean, so you are sort of seeing these things. I mean, you already had the epiphany at a young age of there's no free will, but then as you get into your scientific life, you start to do all these scientific experiments and reading other people's experiments, and you're starting to see how all of this comes together from a scientific standpoint. It's to use the title of your book, it's determined, right?
It's determined. And it's at this point, I mean, I've now that book subtitle, A Science of Life Without Free Will. And that subtitle alone has pissed off a huge number of people. And I've had all sorts
Fantastic.
Of debates with interesting philosophers and such who heartily disagree with me, who believe the world is made of atoms and molecules, and we have cells and all sorts of modern stuff, yet somehow there's still room to shoehorn free will into there. And when you look at how their arguments run for it, there's usually one or two steps of magic where you pull a rabbit out of the hat. But you argue that point with enough people, and their general stance is sort of, oh yeah, like go prove there's no free will. Go prove there's no elves. Go prove there's no Easter Bunny. Go prove any of those. And at this point, as you said, you learn enough factoids about the brain and hormones and genes and history and all of that, and you put it together, and it forms such a tight matrix of explaining how we become who we are, that is right around there that you want to turn the tables and say, no, 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 no. Go study neuroscience and hormones and genes, and then come back to me and show me how free will works amid all that. Show me where there's a moment where your brain is free of its history, free of everything that came from a millisecond ago to like how you evolved as a hominin over millions of years and everything in between. Stop telling me, go prove there's no free will. Show me how it works with the modern knowledge that we have. And nobody can.
No. And that's sort of the amazing thing about science. Quick little tangent. Do you feel like you're the free will guy? I mean, you know, obviously from my perspective, that's the only thing that I really know you. I know that you're obviously a very well-rounded scientific personality. You've written other books. But because of what you have said about this, do you feel like you are being sort of pigeonholed as the free will, there is no free will guy?
Yeah, I used to be the stress guy, and I was kind of the baboon guy, and various incarnations of that. But I guess, yeah, I spent 5 years writing this book, and I realized I was using some notes that I had went back to college in terms of how much this has been running through me. So
at Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Yeah, I kind of have become this hothead in it, in that I take sort of two lunatic fringe stances in this whole free will debate. The first one is just how extreme my stance is, which is I don't believe there is any free will whatsoever. There's no room for it. And a demonstration of a brain that once acts independent of all of its history, you've just proved there's free will everywhere you look, and there's none. There's none at all. And the other extremist stance that I take is most people react to the idea of that getting depressed as hell. Oh my God, there's no purpose and people will just run amok and you're going to have murderers on the street. And does that mean nothing can change? And you work through all those arguments. And in fact, none of them are legitimate fears. And sort of the extremist view I've had is it's in fact a great thing if people stopped believing in free will. Every time we have done that historically, not only does the world not fall apart, it becomes a more humane world. When we figured out, like, storms, lightning storms, are not caused by witches. It doesn't make sense to burn old ladies at the stake. They don't control them. When we learn that epilepsy is not demonic possession, this was not someone who chose to get into bed with Satan, and this is the marker of it. So don't burn them at the stake either. When we learn that there's a neuroanatomical basis to some kids learning, having learning problems when it comes to reading, of dyslexia, rather than they're lazy, they're unmotivated. At each one of these junctures, when we figure it out, oh, actually, I didn't know biology had something to do with that. At each of those junctures, when we subtract out responsibility, it becomes a nicer, more humane world. It's a very good thing when you don't teach people who are overweight that they unconsciously hate themselves and have no self-control, that you teach people who have reading problems that they're lazy, when you teach people with off-putting personalities that they have an unwelcome personality rather than they're actually on the autism spectrum, et cetera, et cetera. In all of those domains, it's taking a cultural standpoint that we have, that we are the captains of our own fate, American individualism, and what that leads us to do is have a world in which lots of people are treated way worse than average for reasons they had no control over. And then there's a societal sort of myth that this is a just world and you could make of yourself what you want. Get rid of free will, and it is very liberating.
Yeah. And we have come to all of those conclusions because of science, the thing that you have devoted your life to, the thing that some people don't want to believe in for some reason. I have always been very scientifically minded. You know, in school, I was always more math and science than reading and writing. Those were my weaknesses. Math and science were my strengths. I am by no means a scientist. I do video work for a living and obviously podcasting in some form. But science is always there. That very analytical way of looking at the world is always there. And so your book Determined was so fascinating to me. I'm a slow reader. I will be honest, the science that you discuss in there is so over my head, but I have been determined to read it, to get through it. And you know, your sense of humor in the book really shines through. I'm about halfway through. There's like a change happening at this moment in the book. I haven't been reading it for a while, but we're sort of getting into a new section, which I'm excited to get into. There's another book that I wanted to mention called, I think it's called Brainscapes. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's actually written by an old high school a peer of mine, Rebecca Schwartzlos. And that was also another fascinating book about how our body is mapped onto the brain, you know, various things. And so that was also a fascinating book to me. But this, when you bring science into the free will conversation, I was so fascinated. You know, because this is a book about, or this is a podcast where I read the dictionary, I will quickly read through what the dictionary has to say about free will, but I do have some other questions for you. So, you know, first word in this episode is free will. This one is one word. This is an adjective from 1535. Robert, you're getting to see a little bit of how this podcast works.
Okay.
The synonyms for this entry are voluntary and spontaneous. I'm trying to think of if I've ever heard of anybody use free will as an adjective to describe something. Can you think of an example of where we might use this?
Not especially. It does.
Yeah, I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, I firmly believe free will comes in two words. So that shows we've split in the road somewhere dramatically.
Right. Well, let's go on to then the next entry, which is really the only other entry here in this book. This one is free will, two words, noun from the 13th century. There's two definitions. Number one is voluntary choice or decision. That's the whole definition. And the example is, I do this of my own free will. I do this action because I'm voluntarily choosing it or deciding it. And of course, I think with you and all of your research, you might have something to say about that. But I will quickly move on to number two, which is, I think this is where it gets a little bit more interesting. This is freedom of humans, calling humans out specifically here, freedom of humans to make choices that are not determined by prior causes or by divine intervention. I mean, I guess right off the bat, do you have any comments on that?
Well, that's a fun one. I think not with a 10-foot pole, but I want to go anywhere near issues of divine intervention. Yeah. So all of this is theology-free from my standpoint, because, you know, it's that one is impregnable to any sort of counter arguments. But sure. Just the whole notion that, like, that's making explicit what I was saying before. Somebody chooses something free of their history. And, you know, that's an okay definition for free will. And show me when that happens. And that never happens. And the reason why, I mean, where people really believe they are seeing free will is we make choices. We make a gazillion choices. We choose coffee or tea, whatever. We make that choice. We make it consciously. we have a pretty good sense that if we say to the person at Starbucks, tea, you're going to get tea rather than coffee. You know you're not being coerced to do this. There are alternative behaviors available to you. And for most people and the criminal justice system, that's necessary and sufficient to decide somebody showed agency, culpability, responsibility. And that's where like all of the free will debates play out. And from my view, it's totally boring because that's the wrong place to be looking. Because if you're looking at when we make a choice, you're missing 99% of what's going on because you're not asking, how did you become the sort of person who would value that so that you would choose that? And that's where we had no control at all. Yes, you arrive at a point where you could make a choice, but it's not a free choice because you were not able to choose. You could not choose to value something more than the things you value. You could not choose to have intent different from what you intend. And you arrive at that. And the free will debate is how you arrive at the moment where you have intent. It's not whether or not you can act on that intent.
And so, I mean, just quickly, I think there's a couple of big things in your argument that really, and there, I'm sure there's a lot more than just these two things, but in my mind, the things that I remember, there are these two big things, which really come down to nature and nurture. Those are the two words that we like to use for these. You know, the nature side of that is your genetics. You know, who your parents came together to make you, you. You are physically this being. And you know, that is your race, that is your height, that is all these different sorts of things, diseases that you might get in the future, or that, you know, when you're a baby. And then the nurture side of it is, what is your environment? What are you growing up with? What are the personalities of the people, your parents, your friends, your teachers, all the people close to you that you sort of take on unconsciously, and you have no control over any of those things? And I was actually talking to a friend tonight before I was telling him that I was going to be talking to you, and he mentioned the finger wiggle experiment. And I don't remember if you had specifically mentioned the finger wiggle experiment, but the whole point of it, which you definitely did talk about in the book, was, you know, when people are hooked up to all these brain scans, they say at some point, wiggle your finger. And what they found, obviously, you know this, is that in the brain, the choice to make your finger wiggle happened before you were conscious of it. And then, of course, it was before you actually did the action. This gets into the world of the very hardcore science in the book that was very difficult for me to get through. But like I said, I was determined. So I had to learn about the neurons and everything that's happening there. But could you talk just a little bit about what's sort of going on in the brain in a situation like that?
Yeah, this is this famous experiment. You talk about free will, and you're practically required by law to mention this, the Libet experiment, this guy Benjamin Libet at UC San Francisco, who, depending on your taste, in the 1980s did a study that disproved free will, or didn't disprove it, but it was essentially showing you could find an indicator in the brain with electrodes, EEGs on your skull, eventually brain imaging, fancier techniques, you could see when the brain had committed to moving your finger. And the person's job was to say when they first realized they were about to do that, and the brain had decided before they knew it. Oh my God, your brain decides before you even know it. You just believe you made that decision, your brain. And that was in the 1980s. And people still have like papers entitled things like Libet didn't know squat about what he was talking about. 40 years later, they're still fighting over this as to whether there's a difference between having an intent and realizing you have an intent, if there's a difference between an intent and an urge, and people fight, and this is like played out over fractions of a second, milliseconds, which is exactly where I come in and say, this is totally boring, because it's not asking, not only how did they become the sort of person who would move their finger at that moment, how did they become the sort of person who would sign up to be a volunteer in a psych experiment? How did they wind up in a university? How did they wind up learning how to read instead of being protein malnourished? How did they wind up being somebody who signed up to come in Tuesday at 3 o'clock and actually had the self-regulation to show up on Tuesday at 3 o'clock and to not like steal somebody's computer when the grad student was looking the other way? How did they turn out to be the sort of person who would be sitting there at that moment in that experiment? And framed that way, intent versus awareness of intent, it's all after the interesting stuff has gone on.
Mm. It's so much to think about. And I mean, this is one of those things that I like talking to people who, especially people who I've never met before, because you start to learn a little bit about a person and all those things that you're saying. How did they become the type of person to do these things or not do those other things? And it gets a little bit overwhelming to me, because there's all of these humans and personalities out there in the world, and they all have a story. They all started somewhere, and it all led them to whatever moment they're in right now. And it's kind of fascinating to me. I feel like I'm getting a little off track, but there's so much to think about and talk about. I just a couple of things that I found interesting in that definition. It calls out humans specifically. You know, when we think about animals, we look at animals as not being quote unquote as conscious as humans are, because they don't think.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Think about the fact that they're thinking, they're just living, they're just existing, they're going on instinct. And so they're just living their lives, and they don't concern themselves about free will or not. And then, of course, like you mentioned, divine intervention, that's a whole other ball of wax that we don't need to get into. But it's the things that are not determined by prior causes. And that's really where everything that you're saying comes in, is what are all the things that happened before? Could you talk just briefly about the turtles quote, which you bring up very early on in the book?
Well, it's sort of a motif that runs through the book. This was like, a great anecdote about the philosopher William James, which a bunch of us in college always loved this story. So it seems William James was giving a lecture about the nature of the universe. And he finishes up, and an old woman comes up and says, "Professor James, you have it all wrong." And he says, "Oh, really, madam? How so?" And she says, "The world is on the back of a gigantic turtle." And he says, "Okay, but madam, where does that turtle stand?" And she says, "On the back of another turtle." And like indulgently, he says, "Oh, but madam, where does that turtle?" And she said, "It's no use, Professor James. It's turtles all the way down." And the starting point for the book is like, why did this happen? Because of what happened just before this happened. And why did just before happen? Because of what came just before that. It's turtles all the way down. And it strikes people as a little bit ludicrous to say this was caused by before, going all the way back to like 3 days before the Big Bang kind of thing. And sort of my point is, it's a lot more ridiculous to say somewhere down there, there's a turtle that can float in the air, and that turtle is free will. That's much crazier than the notion that everything that is now because of what happened just before now, and now before all the way down.
Yeah. And I mean, this is just cause and effect constantly. And it's so amazing that you brought up the Big Bang, because that is the logical place to go when you start thinking about this. And you took it one step further. You said 3 days before the Big Bang. Does this hurt your brain? Yeah, I mean, like, what happened before the Big Bang? We don't know.
I don't know.
So, right, it's from a scientific standpoint, do you feel that the entire universe is determined since the Big Bang?
It's determined, but the future is not already set in stone, which seems like a contradiction. Sort of a notion, some dead white male French philosopher, Laplace, I think he was 18th century, saying, he was the first one to formalize, saying, if you could know where every single particle in the universe was right now, you could predict all of the future. You can say everything that, like, the first statement of, like, pure determinism. And that writ modern would be, like, show up 1 second after a Big Bang, and you would know exactly who's going to order what at, like, you know, House of Pancakes Tuesday next afternoon, right, kind of thing. And that's not actually the case. The future has multiple possibilities because of chaoticism, because of non-linearities, because of stuff that not only is not predictable, but is mathematically, demonstrably unpredictable. It will never be predictable, no matter how closely you look at it with the most, like, amazing magnifying glass out there. These are fractal aspects of nonlinearity, how the universe works, which means, like, the future, there are multiple possible futures. How you will respond to whichever one turns out to happen will be entirely the outcome of the turtles all the way down that made you who you were you in that moment, which you didn't choose. You didn't choose your genes. You didn't choose your mother's womb. You didn't choose your parents' socioeconomic status, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, framed that way, there are still multiple possible futures, but how you're going to respond to them, you're not a free agent in that.
Mm. Oh, it gives me so much to think about. There's a lot of layers to it. Would you say Laplace was the one who said that if you had all of the bits of information, you could predict anything? That's very similar to a thought that I've had for many years, which was essentially, if you had enough information, you could predict everything. But I think his is a little bit better, because it's, if you know where all the particles are in the universe, then you can predict everything, which makes a lot more sense, because you would have to be there at the Big Bang to know where all the particles are and where they went. Because it's all connected.
Except that it can't work that way, which is what the revolution was starting in the 60s or so, of chaotic systems, where the whole point is you look at something and, you know, you got reasonably good predictability, but it's not perfect. And you say, aha, if only we could have people fill out 100 answers to questions instead of 10, or if only we had a microscope that was even more powerful, we could really see what's going on, and you have a more powerful degree of resolution, and you get some predictability, but there's still stuff you can't predict. So you look closer and you look closer, and the fractal quality of nonlinear systems is, it's not noise. It is the system that there is a non-linearity in there that is always going to be there, which makes absolute predictability impossible. Butterfly effects, strange attractors and such, which is, like, totally amazing, but it has nothing to do with the free will stuff, because the future is subject to butterflies flapping their wings. But how you're going to respond to it will have been a function of what womb you were in, and what family, and what genes, and what ancestry, and what you had for breakfast today, and what you smelled in the air 30 seconds ago. All of that represents turtles that came before.
Yeah. I think there's an inevitable thought when you hear everything is determined. And I think what you're saying about the fractal nature of everything sort of disproves my next thought, but it's hard not to think about the phrase, it's all meant to be. When you hear that things are determined, oh, it's meant to be. Is that a phrase that you think about or you've heard other people talk about in relation to all this?
Yeah, and it's granting that big, empty, indifferent universe agency or personhood or something, that the universe can mean anything. It doesn't mean a damn thing. There is nothing that is meant. And when you take any of this lack of free will stuff to its logical extreme, it means praising someone and rewarding them makes no sense. Punishing someone, blaming them makes no sense. Feeling as if you are entitled to anything, that you have earned anything due to your own efforts, makes no sense at all. And like hating somebody for what they've done is like hating an earthquake. It's just, there is no meant to be.
Right. And that was something that I struggled with for a little bit. And the more I thought about it, I guess I realized it's not that it's meant to be. It's just that I had a good word or a phrase for it that I can't think of at the moment. It's just, it's determined. It's just the next logical step. Making it the phrase it's meant to be, like you said, brings in a whole other level of consciousness to the universe, which that's, again, we won't get into that.
Yeah. The present is just is, and the past is just a collection of is-is without a meant to be, and the future is just going to be a collection of is-is without a should be.
That is a good phrase to think about, for sure. This was something that I thought was interesting that I've heard, which I think is definitely connected to stuff that you've been talking about. I have heard that some dogs, or maybe all dogs, because their sense of smell is so strong, so much better than ours, that they can sense a change in your brain or in your body chemistry before you're even consciously aware of it. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, that sounds like taking that Libet experiment, and now we've got somebody's labradoodle as part of the whole thing, which I would assume means you've got 10 times as many variables to argue about afterwards as to what it means. Animals have sensory systems we can't even begin to imagine out there. Animals that like see in infrared, animals who communicate with each other through vibrating their webs. Yeah, there's a whole sensory world out there. We live very sensorially impoverished lives. We humans, we primates, we mammals. There's amazing stuff out there. So I don't know, maybe dogs can do that. They can certainly look cute.
That's really the most important thing, I think, that we just want them to be around.
They've bred us that way to find them cute, and thus we feed them.
Yeah. Breeding goes both ways.
Yep.
I'm just looking at my short little list of questions that I came up with beforehand. Not all of them are necessarily the most important. I guess... When you talk about this to people, one thought is, what do you say to people who completely disagree with you? And then the next part of that question is, do you have any suggestions of how people should live their lives based on this information?
Well, I think... Well, when someone says something like that, I'm almost snarky about this by now, that I'm sitting with someone who is not buying this argument at all, that there's no free will. And it's almost inevitable that at some point, where we're sitting in a cafe or something, at some point they're going to lean over and pick up the salt shaker and say, look, I just picked up the salt shaker. Are you telling me I had no control over that? And... yeah, they're attempting to, how do you become the sort of person? Am I reminding you of your father and you're pissed off at him and now you're pushing back? Mm-hmm. Did you have like stomach cramps this morning and thus you're feeling less agreeable? Are you, in the face of that, I think probably the broadest way of summarizing the implications of there being no free will and how we're supposed to conduct our lives is, if you think you understand why someone is doing what they do, you're almost certainly wrong. And so be real damn cautious before you make any sort of judgments about it, because you're probably wrong. And you're also probably wrong when you assess how it is that you've accomplished what you have or have not.
Yeah, there's always so much more going on in somebody's lives and brain and mind and emotions than we will ever understand. Yeah. And I know it's a maybe a little bit of a snarky question, but you know, the question of how do you suggest people live their lives with this information? My guess, I have a prediction of how you would answer that, but I would like to hear it from you.
You know, I haven't believed in free will for more than half a century, all of that. And I think blame and praise and none of that makes any sense intellectually or ethically. And all that said, most of the time I function completely as if I believe there's free will. Like maybe once a month, I can have 3 minutes where I can really disconnect myself from my time and place and sort of do things that way. It's hard. It's incredibly hard. Somebody cuts you off in traffic, you're pissed off at them. Somebody compliments you on your bow tie and you decide you're a more worthy human. Like, it's very hard to resist this stuff. But we've done it over and over historically. I mean, it's taken us 400 years to decide that epilepsy is a neurological disorder rather than demonic possession. And there's plenty of parts of Africa that I saw where it's still demonic possession. These are long processes. If it's going to take you a ton of work to try to take apart how did they become who they are, and in what ways do I have no clue what that involved, because that's a different universe than I experienced. And what are the ways in which I think I am more worthy that I actually didn't earn? You know, save those for the really tough occasions, like if you're sitting on a jury or if you're deciding whether or not to like pretend not to make eye contact with a homeless person, or when you decide what to make of your kid doing something that's making you irritate, or any, just like save it for when you're making judgments that matter.
Yeah. It feels like the implications of this scientific information are obviously massive. But it feels like most humans probably aren't ready to really listen to that, to really, really understand what the implications are. For instance, like you said, maybe somebody who committed murder shouldn't go to jail for that, because they are not, they are a product of their previous lives, and that they had no control over that, right? So like that is obviously hugely mind-boggling for people to get over that idea.
While emphasizing that nonetheless you have to protect society from dangerous people.
Sure.
But you protect society from cars whose brakes don't work. You park them in the garage and don't let them out. But just because you're doing that to them, it doesn't mean they have a bad soul. And that you should bash them over the top of the hood with a sledgehammer every day as punishment for them not having brakes that work very well. It's just an is. And in the process, you got to protect people from dangerous individuals. And you got to do it where that is simply an instrumental intervention.
Right. And still treat the person who might be dangerous, still treat them as a human, because we clearly all have human rights that are equal amongst everybody, which is hard for some people to understand.
Yep.
There's a very crazy cartoon called Rick and Morty. I don't know if you've ever...
Yes. Our kids turned us on to it.
It's amazing, especially from a scientific standpoint. And I remember hearing one of the writers sort of talk about the behind the scenes of, you know, their writing process and things like that. And I will butcher his quote, but he said something like, once you realize that whether or not things are sort of, whether there's free will or if it's determined, it doesn't really matter. There is a freedom in just sort of allowing life to happen. It doesn't matter if things matter or not. And I try to remind myself of that every once in a while. Like, don't get so stressed out. Don't just chill out. Just relax. Don't get so stressed, because nothing really matters. And a lot of it is determined anyway. So what's the point? And just try to be happy. That's what I try to remind myself.
Which is great. With a proviso that, like, that's a very even-keeled way to deal with us being biological machines. But we're weird biological machines. Unlike paramecia, we feel pain. And, like, that's aversive. And in some way, that's totally irrational. It can be a bad thing when machines feel pain. It shouldn't be possible for a machine to feel pain. It shouldn't be possible for something good or bad to happen to a machine. But we're a very strange kind that can know our machineness and can feel as if our feelings feel as if they feel real. And thus, it's hard to have that detachment at times.
Right. And that's physical pain and emotional pain. It's all of that that we get it from both sides. Yeah, that's a very difficult thing to get past. And we react to things emotionally, and it's very hard to control those and be conscious of that sometimes. Yep.
But I love you bringing up Rick and Morty. My wife and I love it. We were introduced to it by our kids, and it's just so anarchic, and it's wonderful. Yes.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. I haven't gotten around to the new season yet, but I can't wait to get into that one. And that's a show that you could watch that multiple times and still not even catch everything that's going on in there. I guess for you, what's the future? You know, you've been the baboon guy and the free will guy and the stress guy. What are you working on? What's your day to day? Do you have any new projects on the horizon?
Well, I'm in this familiar stage. I've done 7 books now, and I can begin to see a little bit of the metabolism of, like, writing a book and finishing a book, which is you spend a long stretch afterward thinking you will never, ever be able to learn anything new or organize your thoughts and never just. So I'm still in the, like, that's it. I've nothing coherent to say about anything else ever. So at this stage, you know, maybe what would be great in a few years if our kids get it together is that I'll become the grandpa guy.
There you go. Yes, yes, that will be a lot of fun. I've heard a lot of people say the main reason to become a parent is just so you can become a grandparent.
Well, it's occurring to us that it's going to be spectacular, and so our kids need to hurry up, but not hurry up too much. Hurry up just the right amount.
Any other last words, any last comments, words of wisdom from Robert Sapolsky before we close it up here?
No, other than saluting your not so private dictionary obsession. It's wonderful. There's a lot of things people are obsessed with out there, and this is a noble one. So I salute you.
Well, I guess the funny thing about me and this situation is that I'm not particularly dictionary obsessed or word obsessed, but clearly there's something in me that told me that this would be an interesting and maybe funny concept. I've always found words interesting, the etymology, you know, words sound funny sometimes. But, you know, like I said, reading and writing was always my weakness. So this is sort of a different world for me, but I appreciate the comment, and it has already been an interesting journey, and it will prove to be an even more interesting journey as I go on. And I'm grateful that I get to speak to people like you on occasion for these very particular concepts and words. I don't know if you know her, but Natalia Reagan, I know she's aware of you. I had her on for the Evolution episode. She's a very big science communicator. She's out in LA, and she's very funny, and she brings science in a really fun and interesting way. But anyway, this has been an honor for me to talk with you. I hope we get to do it again. I hope you become a grandpa not too soon. And yes, thank you very much for joining me on this episode.
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again to Robert Sapolsky for joining me on the first part of this episode. Almost an hour in, and we still have oh so many words to get through. So yes, if you are interested in what Robert has had to say, you could check out his book Determined. I know he has another book called Behave. I think he said he's written 7 books. And so, you know, there's probably some pretty interesting stuff in there. I'll put some links in the show notes if you want to check out his stuff. All right. Well, now we need to get to the rest of the words, and I guess I should probably make a sound effect. Is there a sound effect that's related to free will or something being determined? Oh, this stuff hurts my brain. Let's see. I don't know. I'll just go. That was a little bit more intense than I expected it to be. All right, the next word. Now, it's still sort of in the free will world because it is Free Will Baptist. 2 words. The first letters are capitalized. This one is a noun from 1732. It is a member of a Baptist group holding to Arminian doctrine and practicing open communion. I should say that the word Arminian, it's not the people, the Armenians. This is capital A-R-M-I-N-I-A-N. I don't know what that is. Must be something in the Baptist world or the religious Christian world. I'm not sure. But I guess they believe in free will, so maybe they should have a little talk with Robert. Next is free world. 2 words, noun, from 1949. The first letters are often capitalized. This is the part of the world where democracy and capitalism, or moderate socialism, rather than totalitarian or communist political and economic systems prevail. All right. Well, for myself, I need to reword that because there's a lot of stuff in there. So, this is a part of the world where the systems that prevail are democracy and or capitalism and or moderate socialism instead of communism, totalitarianism. I'm just adding isms to those words. I would say probably fascism would fit into that second category as well. So, I am a bigger fan of a couple of these in the free world than one of them. I am a bigger fan of democracy and moderate socialism, or I guess maybe socialism in general, than capitalism. Capitalism, I feel like, is, at least our version of capitalism, seems like it's kind of in the middle of all of this stuff. I don't know. I'm sure from a political, economic standpoint, it's easy enough to argue that capitalism is part of the free world because you don't have somebody, one person controlling things. I don't really know how this stuff works. I'm the worst person. But basically, the places that have democracy and socialism and I guess capitalism are considered the free world. Yeah, that's it for that one. I don't know. It's so complicated when you get into political, economic-y stuff. Free writing. 1 word, noun from 1980. Automatic writing done especially as a classroom exercise. Free write is an intransitive verb. So basically, this is the idea. Is, you know, I haven't really done a whole lot of this, but I do remember them talking about it in my classroom settings. You just write whatever comes to your brain. I feel like there's another term for it, freeform writing maybe, or other ones like that. You don't judge, you don't edit, you just write. You just write. Whatever your hand wants to do, whatever your brain wants to do, you just let it out. Free writing. That's how I take it. It doesn't really give examples. It says automatic writing. You just write automatically. Again, no thinking about it. This is really hard for some people to do. This was not something that I felt like I could do very well. I always needed some more structure to what I was doing. So this was a little weird, a little scary. But I know people who do this not in a classroom. They just do it in their journal, in their day-to-day life. You just let it out, whatever your brain wants to say. And it seems like it's very useful. So you know what? Go ahead. Go ahead and give yourself the freedom to do some free writing. Go have fun with that exercise. You don't have to be in a classroom. Now we have the word freeze. And this is a long one. It's the first form of freeze. Verb from before the 12th century. All right. Mr. Freeze. 1A. To become congealed into ice by cold. Ooh, that's an interesting way to turn into ice. Being congealed? I think of blood. You put blood in a cold situation, it's going to congeal. What makes something congeal and other things not congeal? Is it like the consistency of it when it's in liquid form? 1B is to solidify as a result of abstraction of heat. Abstraction of heat, is that when you're taking the heat out of a situation? When I see abstraction, I think of like abstract thought, abstract paintings, abstract things. 1C, to withstand freezing. To withstand freezing, as in the example, the bread freezes well. It can withstand freezing. And it can withstand it because when you take it out of the freezer, when you unfreeze it, when you reheat it, I don't know if you're reheating it exactly, when you're thawing it, it comes back into a great form. It's not messed up in any way. What are some things that don't withstand freezing? I would say my head. I don't think my head would withstand freezing very well. 2, to become chilled with cold, as in almost froze to death. I almost froze to death. I walked outside and it was 40 degrees and I felt like I almost froze to death. I think the people in Southern California, they say this. When the temperatures get down to like 65 Fahrenheit, they're like, I almost froze to death. I needed to put on a sweater. That's how we talk over here. I got a chilled with cold. All right, where are we now? We are at 3. To adhere solidly. Did I do a sound effect in the middle of this word? I'm feeling like I have a memory of that. Maybe, I don't know. I'm going to try and be aware of that going forward. 3. To adhere solidly by, or as if by, freezing. The example is, pressure caused the metals to freeze. Pressure caused the metals to freeze? You just squeeze those metals really hard. Here, I got one of them clampy paper clips. If I squeeze this metal, will I make it be able to freeze? Nope, I'm not that strong. To adhere solidly by or as if by freezing. So when you are squeezing the metals together, they will adhere to each other because of the pressure, and they might literally be frozen or not. It just as if by freeze, similar to something like freezing. 4, to become fixed or motionless, especially to become incapable of acting or speaking. Sometimes, when you're in a situation and there's a very scary thing, you might freeze. You might not know what to do. Your brain is saying, oh, you gotta move, you gotta get away from there, get it going, but your body's like, no, I'm going to freeze. I can't do anything. I'm very, very scared. Please and thank you. When people get in front of a camera or in front of a group of people, this is a very common place where they freeze. I had an audition in high school for a show, a student-directed show, and it was sort of a freeze situation. This is one of those like very important moments in my life that I feel like sort of affected my path. But I won't go into the details, but long story short, I went into the audition, how do I even describe this? I was not the type of person to really be like overly animated and extroverted, and so I just sort of stood there and didn't really do anything. There's more details, but it's not important. Oh, it feels so uncomfortable to be in a situation like that. I'm trying not to freeze so much. All right, now we got number 5. To become clogged with ice. I am just noticing all of these are intransitive, by the way. I missed that. To become clogged with ice. The ice put on some clog shoes and they went to clogging. Clog dancing. The example is the water pipes froze. This is very bad. When you are leaving town for the winter for a very long time, I think they say to turn on your faucets very, very, very slightly. Just a little bit of a drip just to keep them from freezing. I know it feels like it's a waste of water, but you don't want your pipes to freeze because then you're going to have a whole lot of other problems, and that's bad. When the water is not running through it, there's just water stuck in there, and then the temperatures get really cold, and then they freeze, and then ice expands, and so your pipes will possibly maybe break. And that's also really not good. All right, I hate it when my pipes freeze. My vocal pipes froze. All right, now we are getting into the transitive world. Number 1A, to harden into ice. 1B, to convert from a liquid to a solid by cold. That's how you do it. You cold it. You make it cold. You put it in a cold situation. When you want your liquid to be solid, you put it in a cold situation, and then it shall become cold. Some things have a very high temperature of what makes them freeze, and some things have a very low temperature that makes them freeze, and so it all depends on your substance. Is it gonna congeal or do something else? Number 2, to make extremely cold, and the synonym is chill. Chill, I'm just gonna chill. I'm gonna put on some sunglasses. I'm gonna freeze because I'm so chill. Oh, I hit my funny bone a little bit. Okay, now we have 3A. To act on, usually destructively, by frost. So this is something, maybe the weather, maybe Jack Frost, the winter, the very cold, cold temperatures are acting on a thing by frost, and it's usually in a destructive way. It's going to break stuff, like your pipes freezing. 3B, to anesthetize by cold. Now, I know that you can anesthetize with chemicals. You inject it into your arm and then you go sleepy time. But to anesthetize by cold, there's also like when they're going to do, I think, heart surgery or stuff like that. They put you in an ice bath. I don't know if that's literally anesthetizing you to make you go to sleep, but it's definitely making your body like slow the hell down. All right, yeah, I don't have a specific example of that. Number 4, to cause to grip tightly or remain in immovable contact. To cause to grip tightly or remain in immovable contact. So this is the action because it's transitive. Something is making something else be in contact but not moving. So holding on to my music stand real tight, and then something else makes me freeze, so I'm stuck holding this thing forever. But luckily I'm not, so I can let go. Let it go. All right, now we have number 5A. To cause to become fixed, immovable, unavailable, or unalterable. As in, freeze interest rates. Oh, this is, I was just hearing them talk about that this morning on a podcast. I'm recording this out of order because of having to schedule the record with Robert, which is always happens with a guest. But I'm recording this on July 16th, and I think I don't remember exactly what they were saying, but they were definitely talking about how the tariffs are affecting the economy and the inflation, and the people would like to adjust the interest rates, but the tariffs are making that kind of hard, and so sometimes they gotta freeze the interest rates. So they're not going up or down. They're just stuck. They're stuck. They're unalterable, unavailable, not unavailable. That's a different example. Immovable and fixed. I finally got a fixed interest rate mortgage on my condo. So my interest rate is frozen, so it's not going to move for a while. 5B. To immobilize by governmental regulation the expenditure, withdrawal, or exchange of. Worded a little funny. To immobilize. So you are immobilizing the expenditure, withdrawal, or exchange of a thing by government regulation. The government is regulating the thing. It's immobilizing all of those things that I said. And the example is freeze foreign assets. Yeah, I'm not getting into the whole government political stuff, as I said before, because I don't know what I'm talking about. 5C, to render motionless. That's it. Just making a thing stop moving. As in, a fake froze the defender. When the soccer player, the football player, or the hockey player was going up to the defender, they faked like they were going to go one direction, but then they went the other direction, and the defender was like, huh? What do I do? I don't know what to do in this situation, so I have been frozen by your wonderful fake. Number 6. To attempt to retain continuous possession of, without an attempt to score, usually in order to protect a small lead. And the example of what you are holding on to, you have possessed, is a ball or a puck. Again, it could be hockey or soccer or football or basketball. That would be one. So, attempt to retain continuous possession of a ball or puck without an attempt to score in order to protect a small lead. So, the first example I can think of is at the end of the game. When they're oh so very close to winning the game, the one team is like, oh, we got a lead. We want to hold on to that lead. We don't want you to score. And we're going to run out the clock. We're going to run out the clock. We're just going to hold on to the ball. I'm just going to dribble the ball. I'm going to just walk around casually. I'm not going to try to score, because if I score, then maybe you'll take it and then you'll score and then you'll win. And I don't want that to happen. So I'm just going to keep on dribbling this ball. I'm going to run out the clock. I'm going to freeze. But I have to keep on dribbling, so I'm not literally frozen. But it's the same idea. All right, enough of the dribbling. Freezingly is an adverb. And we got to look at the etymology. Let's see. Middle English, fressen. Old English, frilson. Akin to the Old High German, frilson. Again, I don't know how to say that. That means to freeze. From the Latin, pruina, which means hoarfrost, which is H-O-A-R, frost. From the Old English, frost, which means frost. It's basically from the idea of cold. When something gets cold, it doesn't move, typically. I can't think of something that's frozen that moves. And so that's why we have all these definitions about making a thing not move, not change, not being altered, fixed in place, not literally cold, but it's not changing. So that means now I have to make a sound effect and move on to the next word. The second form of freeze is a noun from the 15th century. Number 1A, an act or instance of freezing. It's a freeze. 1B, the state of being frozen. When you put the bread in the freezer, the bread is in a freeze. It's like, oh, it's so cold in here. Oh, this feels so good. It was so hot out there and I was sweating. And now, ooh, you put me in the freezer and this feels good. And now I'm in a state of being frozen. Thank you very much. I shall come back fresher than ever when you thaw me out. Number 2, a state of weather marked by low temperature, especially when below the freezing point. We got a freeze coming. Well, not here. Not right now. I'm in the Northern Hemisphere, and it is summer. It is super duper summer. It is hot. I can pretty safely say this is the hottest summer I have experienced so far. And we're only, like, what, halfway through? But in the Southern Hemisphere, right now, they might be experiencing a freeze with temperatures below the freezing point of 32 Fahrenheit or 0 Celsius or centigrade. We haven't hit the Kelvin. What's the Kelvin freezing? Is it negative 235 or something? Number 3, a halt in the production, testing, and deployment of military weapons, as in a nuclear freeze. Don't make any more nuclear stuff. Let's freeze on that. We're good. We're good. We got plenty of nuclear stuff. We don't need any more of those things. Moving on to freeze-dried. Two words with a hyphen, adjective from 1946. This is being in a state produced by or as if by freeze-drying, which that's our next word. Let's just get right into that. When you freeze dry something, maybe you're pulling out all of the moisture, maybe, and it goes, I'm freeze dried. Here's freeze dry, two words with a hyphen, transitive verb from 1949. So the adjective came 3 years before the action of doing the thing? This doesn't make any sense. It is to dry as food in a frozen state under high vacuum, especially for preservation. Is this the astronauts back in the day when there was freeze-dried ice cream and freeze-dried hot dogs? Is that what they were doing? Was it freeze-dried? Maybe it was a little bit of a different something. I don't know. Let's look up. You know. And then, of course, I have to comment that if it was freeze-dried, I shall say that when we would go to the Museum of Science and Industry back in the day, they would have freeze-dried or whatever astronaut ice cream packets, and it was like a weird, almost powdery consistency, and it was such a weird novelty that we loved it oh so much. All right, let's just look up. What did astronauts eat on the moon? Sure. Now, these days, astronauts are eating some much nicer things than back in the day. I don't know if they're still freeze-dried, but they're definitely in packets, and I think that they gotta add water. Let's see. The first meal eaten on the moon by Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong included freeze-dried bacon squares, peaches, sugar cookie cubes, a pineapple grapefruit drink, and coffee. Fascinating. It was consumed inside the lunar module. The food was primarily freeze-dried to remove moisture, making it lightweight and preventing spoilage. They would add water to the food packages using a special water injector, then rehydrate the food by mixing it. Yeah, I think that's pretty similar to what they're doing now. The food packages were color-coded and labeled for each day, making it easy for astronauts to select their meals. Blah, 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 blah. Bacon squares were the first food consumed on the moon. bacon squares. Ooh, is this a picture of the bacon squares? Oh, I don't know what this is. Some of the space food was scheduled to be carried on the Apollo 11 lunar landing mission, including from left to right, chicken and vegetables, beef hash, and beef and gravy. Yep, they are cubes, rectangular blocks of food in packages where they've sucked out everything. And then there's a thing on the end where you inject the water into it. And so then you just mix it around. And I'm sure it tasted great. I don't know. Anyway, that's freeze dry. You are, it's in a frozen state. So they, with the vacuum, they pull out all the stuff, all the moisture. And then is it frozen? Literally frozen? Or is that, are they just calling it frozen because it's not active? There's no water? I don't know. That's the sound of the vacuum sucking out all the stuff. Next is freeze etching. Two words with a hyphen. Noun from 1968. The synonym is freeze fracture, which is our next word, so let's do that. Freeze fracture. Like when you fracture a bone. This is two words. Noun from 1973. So it seems like freeze etching was earlier, and then they were like, well, we got a better term for it 5 years later. So let's use that one instead. This is preparation of a specimen, like tissue, for examination by an electron microscope after freezing, fracturing along natural structural lines, and preparing a replica. And I guess an example of this replica, or the way that they did this, was by simultaneous vapor deposition of carbon and platinum. Platinum. Whew, this is, okay, so this is basically preparing a thing to be viewed by an electron microscope, and they called it freeze fracture, because they would freeze it, and then they would fracture it, break it, along natural structural lines, but I don't know what types of things. You got a tissue, a skin, a muscle, a something, and then you break it after it's frozen. It's easier to break after it's frozen. That's a scientific fact. And then you can look at it. You can look at the cross-section of it, I guess, under the electron microscope. Freeze fracture is an adjective. Freeze it, then fracture it. Freeze it, then fracture it. Freeze and break and freeze and break and freeze and break and look at it. All right, moving on to freeze frame. Two words with a hyphen, noun from 1948. Number 1A. A frame of a motion picture film that is repeated so as to give the illusion of a static picture. My favorite example of these is at the end of a sitcom where they just freeze on something, and hopefully they have frozen on everybody jumping up in the air and doing a fun pose. I think I did a similar pose for the word frame, where I did a freeze frame just to show you one frame, but I guess I could do it again. We could do an actual freeze frame. Can I jump here? Can I, in this little space, can I do a freeze frame jump? There we go. I'll freeze that one. All right, now we have 1B. This is a static picture produced especially from a video disc or videotape recording. Right, we're not talking about film. It's much easier to pause on a videotape or a video disc on your player to see a freeze frame. It's just stuck there. It's not moving. So the thing about 1A is that when you would see a freeze frame, they would just repeat one frame over and over again. So there were many, many frames of the same image. But when you stop on a videotape or something, it's not moving. It's just stuck there. It's frozen. Number 2, something resembling a freeze frame, especially in unchanging quality. My qualities are unchanging, so I am a freeze frame. Freeze frame is also a transitive verb. Next is freeze out. Two words. Transitive verb from 1861. The synonym is the word exclude. Oh, You're going to exclude me from your party? You're freezing me out, man. I want to go to your party. Why don't you want me at your party? Is it because I just am talking into a camera all the time? No. Freeze out is a noun. Don't do a freeze out. Next and very last word in this episode. It is freezer. Noun from 1843. One that freezes or keeps cool, especially a compartment, room, or device for freezing food or keeping it frozen. One that keeps cool. I'm just keeping cool when I put those sunglasses on. I'm Snoopy Joe Cool. I'm keeping cool. I'm a freezer. It's always fun to go to an example like that when you're talking about cool stuff. You know, not to brag, but we have a freezer. It's connected to our refrigerator, and we put stuff in there. You know, we got fruit, we got frozen fruit, we got frozen vegan meats. What all we got in there? We got some Trader Joe's vegan breakfast sausages. We got some of their Trader Joe's little dill falafel. Those are really good. You should pick up some of those. No, don't pick up some of those, because then there will be less for us. We've got some very old, like, impossible meat that's probably not good anymore. I think we have an old frozen pizza that is also not good anymore because it's been in there for a very long time. We should clean that out. A lot of frozen fruit. We got some frozen veggies, some frozen stuff that, when you get hurt, maybe you need an ice pack. We keep the ice packs in the freezer. That's a pretty good place to keep them. Recently I had some frozen banana in there because the bananas were going bad. So we took you take the peel off, maybe you break it up into sections, you put it in a bag, you put it in the thing, and then you got frozen bananas. I put those in a smoothie. I sure did. All right. The freezer, very helpful. You should make sure that it's, make sure it doesn't have freezer burn, all the ice and stuff. You got to chip that stuff away, I guess. All right. Let's pick a word of the episode. We had free will, free will, free will Baptist, free world, free writing, freeze, freeze, freeze dried, freeze dry, freeze etching, freeze fracture, freeze frame, freeze out, and freezer. Well, I guess maybe because we spent so much time on it and it's just such a fascinating topic, maybe I should pick free will. Although, if free will doesn't exist, then do I want to pick it as the word of the episode? I don't know. Sure, whatever. We'll pick free will as the word of the episode. Is there free will anywhere? I don't know. I don't think so. Science says no. No free will. No free will. Do whatever you want because you don't have control over it. That was a song by me. I am not going to tell you about a movie that I watched because everything is completely out of order and we can't have that sort of chaos. I shall not allow it. So this has been Spencer dispensing information, partially with Robert Sapolsky, who wrote the book Determined, and you should go check out his stuff and read what he has to say because it seems pretty fascinating. And the other book, Behave, also sounds very fascinating. Everything is fascinating to me. Everything is fascinating. Anything else to say? Did I say this has been Spencer dispensing information? Goodbye.